You're listening to Thought Huddle. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This is a podcast produced by Arizona State University, and it's for audiences everywhere, not just those under the desert sun. We engage with fascinating people on a wide variety of subjects, people who are thinkers and doers and motivated by the desire to create meaningful impact. Thought Huddle explores ideas, tells stories, and hopefully makes some sense of our complicated and beautiful world. Aliens. What does that word make you think of? Little green men with big heads? Giant scaly guys from Star Trek? Disembodied intelligence from super sophisticated spaceships? Or maybe primordial slime things? I'm going to say up front, I've always been agnostic on the subject of aliens. I've never really spent that much time looking into the question of aliens or UFOs, because frankly, there's so much interesting stuff here on Earth already. But once you start looking, there's a whole world of endlessly fascinating research, experiences, and speculations. Some of it is off-the-wall crazy, and some of it is outright deception. Aliens and UFOs are big business. And some of it is real and very important. Today we'll be talking about all of it, from the scientific to the psychotic. To start this program, I went to Roswell, New Mexico this past July for the annual UFO Festival, which draws tens of thousands of people every year. Roswell is the site of a, well, let's call it incident, in July of 1947, a crash of some kind, after which the Roswell Army Airfield told the world that a flying saucer had crashed nearby. It's a famous headline in the Roswell Daily Record that reads, RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. Almost immediately, they changed their story from flying saucer to weather balloon, and then, decades later, after the fall of the Soviet Union, they said it was a high-altitude nuclear test balloon to monitor the Russian nuclear program. But the flying saucer story captured the public imagination and set in motion decades of cultural and investigative activity, not to mention endless conspiracy theories. You'll hear people insist that there were aliens in the crash, both dead and alive, yes, with big eyes and big heads, or that there was an alien spacecraft whose crash left bits of metal that had unearthly properties, like extraordinary resilience and flexibility. Even now, over 70 years later, there are people taking metal detectors out to the purported crash site looking for those alien materials. Except there are six different sites in the New Mexico desert where this crash supposedly happened, each site dependent on different theories and ever-changing testimonies. When I was in Roswell, I talked to people who believed that they were abducted by aliens, or that their relatives were, or that their hypnotherapy clients were, or that there was an alien standing at the end of their bed beaming them telepathic messages. And of course, there are hundreds of films and TV shows, not to mention countless books of science fiction, most of them from 1950 on, perhaps not coincidentally after the Roswell incident. Fictional aliens were everything from hostile people-eaters to tall, wise, gentle souls intent on saving us from ourselves. So, aliens. Where do we start? And how do we study the question of aliens in a reasonable and scientific manner? A good place to start is SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, an institute in California where distinguished scientists from fields including astronomy, astrobiology, chemistry, geology, and physics ask big questions about the origin of life and the possibility of life beyond Earth. Paul Davies is a theoretical physicist, cosmologist, and astrobiologist. He is Regents Professor and Director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science, co-director of the Cosmology Initiative at Arizona State University, and he's the author of several books, including The Eerie Silence, Renewing Our Search for Alien Intelligence. He wrote that book to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the SETI endeavor. I asked him how he got interested in the idea that there might be life beyond Earth, and how he sustained that interest over his long career.
It's a very curious thing. I was fascinated as a teenager with the idea of life beyond Earth, probably due to exposure to science fiction. And in those days, and we're talking back in the 60s, nobody, almost no scientist, was prepared to entertain the idea of extraterrestrial life. One might as well have professed an interest in looking for fairies. It was considered so bizarre. And because I've always gone against the trend I sustained the interest by thinking, oh, well, you know, there's a conspiracy of silence or something. What is the matter with these scientists? There's this huge universe out there, and surely there's going to be life somewhere. I became more seriously interested professionally in the 1980s, and a turning point for me was a conference that Martin Rees, now Britain's Astronomer Royal, held in Cambridge, UK in 1983, and got me thinking very much about the nature of life. And the strange thing that happened in the 1990s, the pendulum swung, and suddenly even very distinguished scientists were saying, oh, well, the universe must be teeming with life. And NASA created its Astrobiology Institute in the mid-90s, and suddenly everybody was jumping on the life is everywhere bandwagon. And for me, being a contrarian sort of fellow, that meant I swung the other way. I began to get skeptical. I remembered the things people said to me in the 60s and 70s, and I said them back. What justification do you have for believing in life beyond Earth? And so I've become very skeptical, but I'm one of these people who would call themselves an interested skeptic. But I have to say I'm much more skeptical now about finding ET than I was when I was a teenager.
So let's say there are lots of planets with conditions that are theoretically conducive to life. What are the chances that life will arise from matter? Do we have any idea? Do we even know how life formed on our own Earth?
We absolutely have no idea how to even estimate the odds. It's just not even guesswork. It's just wishful thinking to say that just because there are billions of Earth-like planets in our galaxy, there will be billions of planets with life on it. We just don't know what that number is because we don't know the process that turned non-life into life. So I keep emphasizing this point to my astrobiology colleagues, and somehow they don't seem to get it. The point here is that you can't estimate the odds of an unknown process.
We really don't know how life came to be on Earth, as you say, so we don't know whether it's likely to happen somewhere else, or even if it might have happened more than once here on our own Earth, though there's no evidence for that so far. Then there's the question of how we even define life. Does it have to be water and carbon-based? Is there a different set of chemical compounds that could give rise to beings that reproduce and move around and things like that?
You're asking one of the great foundational questions of astrobiology, which is we can go look for life, but what exactly we're looking for, we lack a definition of it. Now, obviously, if we were to go to Mars and find something like a ribosome, we would say that inevitably that is life or the product of life. But what we would really like is an objective definition of life based not upon the stuff of which we're made or it's made, but upon its informational properties. And at ASU, we have a big research program. A lot of this is in the Beyond Center. I'm deeply involved in trying to come up with an informational definition of life. That is a software definition, not a hardware definition. So if you say, well, is it going to be carbon-based? That's like saying, does a computer have to be silicon-based? And we all know that the secret of a computer lies really with its software, its information processing capabilities, not with the actual physical hardware of which it's made. You need the hardware, but it doesn't have to be any particular type of hardware.
So this is a huge topic, namely whether entirely technological intelligence can be considered life, and whether the aliens that many people think are out there, if they even exist, might be technological beings. We'll get back to that. But let's say that life as we usually think of it, biological life, arises on another planet. Is there any reason to think that it would evolve into technological civilizations that could create technology and that would send spaceships to other planets like our planet? I mean, maybe there are a lot of planets covered with alien bacteria or little things like that that we have no way of knowing about. Would they eventually evolve into civilization-building creatures?
You're touching again on a very profound issue, and it's one that's been fudged during the history of SETI. If you look very carefully at the expectations of SETI enthusiasts, the handful of SETI practitioners, there is this 19th century assumption of evolutionary progress. The idea being that Darwinian evolution has a sort of directionality to it in the direction of greater complexity, leading ultimately to intelligence. It was a view that was very fashionable in the 19th century. human beings were regarded as the pinnacle of this evolutionary ladder of progress. Well, that all went out of fashion a few decades ago, and people said, well, there is no directionality, it's all just sort of random, it's exploring the space of possibilities, that there's nothing exceptional about human beings. It's just obviously we think there is because we are human, and so we're just projecting human values onto the process. This argument is still not completely resolved, and I sit a little bit on the fence on this one. I don't think there's anything inevitable that given a planet with microbes that you're going to get intelligent beings even after a few billion years. So even if life got going and even if it became complex, it's entirely possible that it would never make that transition to what we would regard as our form of intelligence.
But even if it did, you have to ask, if there were intelligent beings in our galaxy or the general neighborhood, why would they want to leave their planet in the first place, even if they had the technology? And then if they did, how would they get here, given the constraints of physics, like vast distances, fuel, the limit of the speed of light, not to mention their life support, whatever that is, unless they were those technological beings that didn't need to eat or whatever. But I mean, are there limits that prohibit interplanetary travel? Do we even know enough to say?
You're right to draw attention to the vast distances between planetary systems, although I don't think the transportation of living beings is really very likely. We can send technology, and indeed I'm involved in Yuri Milner's breakthrough Starshot speculation, I call it initiative, to send microchips to Alpha Centauri riding on laser beams. It's not impossible that there is or was alien technology in our solar system. I don't think aliens, but their technology possibly. The point being that if life is as common as some of my SETI colleagues hope, and if intelligent life is a substantial fraction of planets with life, then it only takes one expansionary community, and by expansionary it doesn't mean the beings themselves, but their technology. It only takes one to populate the galaxy with their stuff. And this is often known as the Fermi paradox. It was spotted back in the 1940s by Enrico Fermi, that if you've got an expansionary community out there somewhere, it's had plenty of time to spread across the galaxy. I don't rule out that this is a possibility. It just takes one. So whereas most communities might be like ours, probably stuck in one place forever and ever, if you get one out there somewhere in our galaxy, then it's been around a long time. The galaxy is 12, 13 billion years old. There could have been planets with life long before Earth even existed. So plenty of time to spread across the galaxy. So if life is common, we would expect to find the products of intelligent life nearby. And who knows? We may. I'm interested in just searching within the solar system, just in case. I think it's a huge long shot, but great fun to do.
The reality is that SETI has not found any signs of alien life after over half a century of searching using the ever-evolving tools that science currently has to offer. So we could sign off here and say there are no aliens, or probably no aliens, at least not that we're going to meet. Let's turn our attention back to earthly matters. Let's study history and dogs and how to cure diseases and solve global problems. Right? But there are weird things at the edges, things beyond SETI's purview, phenomena that can't be explained away. Take UFOs. Now, okay, most UFOs can be explained away. People see things that they're positive or spaceships that turn out to be weather balloons or swamp gas, military aircraft, reflections on their own camera lenses. All that accounts for a good 95% or more of so-called UFO sightings. But the relatively small number of sightings that remain are truly anomalous and mysterious, and to many worthy of further inquiry. One of the problems with actually doing this further inquiry is that if you're a serious researcher, scientist or journalist or whatever, most people will think you're nuts and won't want to have anything to do with you, and they'll dismiss your work without even looking at it. This is called the UFO taboo. The great physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking once said, "I am discounting reports of UFOs. Why would they only appear to cranks and weirdos?" But according to investigative journalist Leslie Kane, UFOs have appeared to a lot of rational, credentialed people, including many whose job it is to keep us safe. Kane has written for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and many other publications, and she's author of the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. I asked her how she began to study UFOs.
It was quite a while ago, that in 1990, that I received a report in the mail from a colleague in France, which was this military study done by very high-level people in France, including generals and admirals and scientists and police and engineers, a whole distinguished group. And they studied all this UFO data from official sources and came to the conclusion that they thought the best hypothesis for the phenomenon was what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And they said it was the most valid and rational interpretation of the data without claiming they could prove it. But that's what got me started in this field as a journalist. I was working at a public radio station at the time. And when this thing landed on my desk, I just thought, whoa, this is huge. Because these were generals. These were very, very high-level people making these statements. I did my first story for the Boston Globe based on that report. And there was a very strong taboo. It was very difficult for me to get a piece published. The editor at the Boston Globe finally had the courage to publish this long story. It was in the Sunday paper, and it was a really big deal. And that's what got me going on this.
I asked Kane how the credible cases are distinguished from the others, you know, the airplane, swamp gas, weather balloons, and so on.
The cases that are significant involve multiple witnesses. They involve radar data. They often involve photographs or videos, communications between pilots and the ground control seeing or not seeing the object, but maybe the onboard radar picks it up or the ground radar picks it up. And you just have a lot of data by very credible people. And when those kinds of events occurred, then they can find out, well, were there any other aircraft in the sky at that time? Were there weird weather phenomena going on at that time? You know, we know exactly when this happened, where it happened, where they were in the sky. We have all the data from the cockpit of the airplane and so on. And so with those kinds of cases, those are the ones that are really, really solid and that suggest that this is something we don't understand.
Kane co-authored an article in the New York Times in December of 2017 in which it was revealed that the Pentagon had a covert UFO program called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, or ATIP, which flew very much under the radar, no pun intended, started in 2007 and funded at the request of Senate Majority Leader at the time, Harry Reid. It was headed by a military intelligence officer named Luis Elizondo. Elizondo resigned in protest because he felt that the program wasn't getting the funding it needed and deserved, and he was concerned that unknown anomalous technologies could be interfering with our national security. In an interview with CNN, he characterizes these objects as, quote, things that don't have any obvious flight surfaces, any obvious forms of propulsion, and maneuvering in ways that include extreme maneuverability beyond, I would submit, the healthy G-forces of a human or anything biological. Hypersonic velocities, low observability, and positive lift. Again, seemingly defying the laws of aerodynamics. He continued, I will tell you unequivocally through observation, scientific methodologies that were applied to look at this phenomenon, that these aircraft, we'll call them aircraft, are displaying characteristics that are not currently within the U.S. inventory nor in any foreign inventory that we are aware of, and that there is very compelling evidence that we may not be alone. That, in a nutshell, is the extraterrestrial hypothesis, the idea that there are intelligent beings from other planets that are sending these spaceships to Earth that can do extraordinary things. Accompanying Kane's December 2017 article in the New York Times about ATIP was some declassified video footage from a Navy training exercise in which pilots spotted an object that they said was shaped like a 40-foot-long Tic Tac hovering near the ocean. One of the pilots steered his plane down to take a better look at it, but then the object took off. In an interview, the pilot said, "It accelerated like nothing I've ever seen. I have no idea what I saw. It had no plumes, wings, or rotors, and it outran our F-18s. The pilots were able to lock the object onto their radar, and this is the cockpit recording of their voices.
Tickle 6-1 Tango, Roger.
Oh, got it!
Did you box moving target?
No, I took an auto track.
Oh, okay.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Wow. Look at that, man. Look at the
In her book, Leslie Kane also goes into the movement patterns of these UFO objects, what they look like and what they do when they're in the air.
I mean, I've heard those descriptions over and over again. The speeds at which they can travel, the fact that they can stop in midair, they can make right angle stop and make a right angle turn. Also the silence. There was a wave of sightings in Belgium in 1989, a general who was involved in that investigation wrote his own chapter about these sightings. And these triangular objects were dead silent, even though they were demonstrating all these extraordinary capabilities. But the most amazing things are just the speed and the maneuverability that they have in the sky.
Now, the United States is not the only country with a UFO program, and in fact, other countries are less covert about their work.
Other countries are not as secretive as we are. France has had a government agency since the 70s that does nothing but studies UFOs, and it's within the equivalent of their NASA, their space studies program. Chile also has a UFO program, and I spent a lot of time working with them. And a lot of other countries in South America also have agencies and are very public about this. In 1990, the Belgian government gave press conferences to explain to people what they were finding out. They would show clips of radar data and update the public about their investigations into these repeated sightings of these triangular objects. So the United States, of course, is the opposite. But I take my hat off to those countries. And I wish there was more openness like that in this country.
So why is it that the United States is so secretive about UFOs compared to other countries? Are they worried about mass panic? Really? Is there something they're hiding? There is another hypothesis about UFOs that says that these airborne objects are secret government projects involving advanced military technologies and very much of this Earth. In an interesting twist on this hypothesis, there are documented cases in which civilians have seen objects that they thought were UFOs and reported them to the military. In fact, these folks had come across military projects that they weren't supposed to know about. So in response, they were called on by military intelligence officers whose assignment, unbeknownst to the civilians, was to disseminate false information. The officers actually told these civilians that they were seeing UFOs, and in a few cases, they even staged fake UFO events and dumped metallic props on the New Mexico desert to lead these UFO enthusiasts to believe that they were discovering the real thing. All this is documented in the book The Mirage Men and a documentary film by the same name. And of course, UFO fakery is not limited to the military. In Diana Pasulka's book, American Cosmic, there's a story about a graphic designer who created a fake UFO picture in order to demonstrate what a fake looks like. This same picture ended up circulating around the internet labeled as a real UFO picture, much to the chagrin of its maker. In another example, a supposed UFO photograph was analyzed and shown definitively to be a weather balloon. Creative UFO enthusiasts then proclaimed that it was a UFO, disguising itself as a weather balloon. And because virtually everyone has a camera on their phone now, there are many more documents of unidentified objects in the sky, but there are also many, many more fakes. So how do we square all this with the well-documented cases by reliable sources of anomalous objects in the sky? Are they all secret government programs? If so, the United States is a lot further advanced than what Luis Elizondo and his colleagues are aware of. It means the U.S. knows how to make flying objects whose motion defies the known laws of aerodynamics, and they've been doing so for decades. Or are they all fakes, somehow staged by military intelligence? In that case, why are they staging events for Navy pilots and other military personnel in remote locations? I want to talk about one more UFO case from Phoenix, Arizona in 1997, known as the Phoenix Lights case. Leslie Kane.
The power of that case were the numbers of witnesses. There were hundreds and hundreds of people who saw these objects gliding over the state of Arizona. And the fact that reports were being made as it happened, and the police departments were all getting inundated with calls. the objects were described consistently by hundreds of people that saw them, and they could actually track the trajectory of the objects. These things were massive, massive objects shaped like boomerangs or triangles, and they moved very, very slowly with no sound. People who saw them were flabbergasted and can't imagine that we have any technology like this. And then 10 years after the event, the governor of Arizona came out and acknowledged that he actually had witnessed the objects himself, but had been, again, because of this taboo you were talking about, was afraid to talk about it at the time.
This was Arizona Governor Fife Symington, who initially dismissed people's accounts, but later admitted that he himself had in fact witnessed these objects. This is Fife Symington in James Fox's documentary film, Out of the Blue.
At that time in over Phoenix, we all experienced a very exciting sighting of some kind of a craft of unknown origin. Nobody's ever been able to explain it. And that it was, most of us feel that it was definitely, of alien origin, enormous, inexplicable, probably one of the major sightings in modern history in the country, because a lot of people saw it in Maricopa County, and I saw it too. And we never got to the bottom of it. We never found out what they were.
Where does that leave us? I know I can't totally write off UFOs as all misidentifications and fakes, but what is the relationship between UFOs and aliens? If there are UFOs that are not of human origin, whatever they might be, do they have pilots? Are they remotely controlled by some kind of intelligence? Alien intelligence or artificial intelligence? And what's the distinction between those anyway?
That is what fascinates me the most about the phenomenon, is the fact that in most cases they demonstrate what military people call intelligent control. They're responsive. They sort of interact. And that, to me, is the most mysterious question of all of it. What is that intelligence? Where is it coming from? Is there something in that vehicle that's responding? The case I mentioned in 1976, where there were these projectiles, that pilot many times was planning to fire back at these projectiles that were coming towards him. And every time he tried to do that, the moment he was pressing the button to fire this missile, he lost control. Everything in his aircraft went dead. All his equipment within the aircraft went dead so that he couldn't fire that missile. And it seemed to him like something was controlling his ability to do that right at the moment he was about to do it. And how could that be? Again, seems to be some kind of manipulation or some kind of intelligence that seems to know things that they shouldn't be knowing.
So still, we're left with the big question to which nobody appears to have a scientific answer. Is there alien intelligence at work here? And that brings us to one of the more bizarre areas in the study of aliens. Our own planet is full of people who believe that they've seen aliens, that they've been abducted by aliens, implanted, experimented on, seduced, or simply greeted by aliens. This is where you get into the little green men thing. Only, as experiencers will tell you, they call themselves experiencers, not abductees, the little aliens are not green, but gray, although some of them are white and still others look like praying mantises. There is an instructor of Korean language at the University of Oxford in England named Young Hae Chi, who believes that there are aliens living on Earth and breeding with humans in order to save us from self-destruction, and specifically to help us deal with climate change. He wrote a book about this in Korean, whose title translates as Alien Visitations and the End of Humanity. Dr. John Mack was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and head of the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He conducted a long-term study of hundreds of people who claimed to have been abducted by aliens. At first, he assumed that they must be mentally ill. But later he came to take them and their stories seriously, though he couldn't fully account for what was going on. He was struck by how emotionally intense and sometimes traumatic these alleged events were for the experiencers, and how consistent they were from one person to the next, even among people who had never met or shared their experiences with others. John Mack died in 2004. The following is from Laurel Chaitin's documentary film about his work. It's called Touched. In the early 90s, Dr. Mack was introduced to an artist who was working with people who claimed to have been abducted by aliens.
I said, come on, give me a break. You know, you believe this? He told me about people from all over the country who didn't know each other, who were reporting virtually the same story. I mean, I'm a clinical psychiatrist, so I work with data. Your data is the people you're working with. That data operated like sulfuric acid to my worldview. I mean, it just didn't compute at all. I mean, my smart-ass mind couldn't do anything with that. By the time I published a book in 1994, I'd seen, you know, I don't know how many, between 50 and 100 cases, and felt pretty solid ground that this was not going to give way to some sort of conventional explanation. I was just behaving like clinicians should behave, I think. It just, here's what I'm finding, recording the cases, writing them up, saying what they said, and what, if this is true, what it implies. You know, I was stuck with this dilemma. What do you do then? Somebody comes to you and they tell you that something's happened to them and they tell it sincerely. They seem to be a healthy person otherwise, not given to delusion or make-believe or anything else. Their family says they've always been very solid and blah, blah, blah. What do you do at that point? Do you say, well, I'm sorry, this got to be some kind of mental illness I never heard of before, because with no indications of that? Or do you say, well, it's like it's happening. Maybe what I thought was possible wasn't complete.
In his book, Abduction, John Mack documents a number of patients whose stories are indeed pretty out there. He starts the book with a history of sightings of aerial phenomena going back thousands of years from societies all over the planet. There are reports that include chariots, fiery shields, triangular and round and cigar-shaped and other kinds of objects in the sky. And many societies, most of them, in fact, according to Mack, have cosmologies that create myths and stories from these experiences and form them into worldviews that integrate material and mystical experience. This is a big contrast to our own society, which tends to acknowledge only material experience as real and then dismisses all things mystical or quote-unquote paranormal. Some of Dr. Mack's patients reported having spiritually transformative experiences, like positive experiences, while others experienced paralyzing fear and helplessness. I think it's notable that these reactions map closely onto the history of spiritual or religious experience, where some people are transformed by their contact with God or gods or angels, and others are terrorized by their experiences with demons. Which brings us to Diana Pasulka. She's a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and she's author of the book American Cosmic, UFOs, Religion, Technology. She spent 6 years researching the question of UFOs and aliens as an outgrowth, believe it or not, of her research in the history of the Catholic Church.
I'd never thought of UFOs, actually. And I was writing a book on the Catholic doctrine of purgatory, which is kind of this afterlife way station before your soul goes into heaven because it's not perfect enough to get there. I'd come across a lot of reports in chronicles, which are basically histories, and reports of aerial phenomena. I wasn't quite sure how to fit that into my book on purgatory, so I just kept a log of these very odd reports. After my book was published, I took my list and I looked at it and I brought it to a friend. We were having coffee and I said, take a look at this list and tell me what you think about this, because I really don't know, you know, what to think of this. And he looked it over and he said, oh, this is Steven Spielberg. You know, this looks like UFOs. And I thought he was crazy.
What were those things on your list from the Catholic literature on purgatory that looked to your friend like UFOs?
Well, first, I would see pictures. Some would be outright discs in the sky. I also would read accounts of people who have seen orbs or flames, like a nun. Here's a classic example. A nun in the 1800s is in her cell, and every night, what she describes as a flame or an orb, something really shiny, comes through her wall and floats above her. And so the mother superior comes in one night and says, I'm going to sleep in your cell with you to observe this. And they observed it. And what they interpreted it as was, this must be a soul from purgatory.
You also write about the 16th century Spanish mystic, St. Teresa of Avila. What happened there?
This is what happened to her. And any of your listeners can pick up her autobiography and read it. She said that one day she was walking along, and right next to her was a being who was about 3 feet tall. And she said that it was shiny. And it was also something that she didn't consider at first to be an angel, because she couldn't put it into the types of angels that she would have known about from the priests and people that she learned from. So she's looking at this, and in her mind, she's thinking, what type of angel is that? And she also said that this angel was real, like corporeal, fleshy. And she said that any angel that she's ever thought she saw was imaginary. And she said that then this angel took an instrument that was also shiny. It had a kind of fire, or it had light on the end of it, and basically put it in her bowels. And she said she felt both pain and ecstasy simultaneously.
What Pasulka's work makes clear is that all this is as much about the interpretation as it is about the experiences themselves. An experience might be interpreted by a Catholic person as purgatory and someone else as a UFO experience.
It's true. So when people think of religion, they don't think of UFOs. And when they think of UFOs, they don't think of religion. But they're actually very, very similar. And even, you know, the belief in UFOs is a new type of form of religiosity. The case I generally use is St. Francis of Assisi. He lived in the 1200s. He was with another brother, and they were praying on a mountain. And this thing comes through the sky, kind of like bursts through the sky amidst lots of sparks and things like that. And it comes down and it focuses and sends some beams into Francis. And Francis then is hurt by these beams. In the Catholic Church, this is then interpreted as stigmata, which are the wounds of Christ. Then it becomes a dogma in the Catholic Church. If you read the primary source of that, though, you see that he actually has some type of telepathic communication with this thing, and he dies from those wounds. Then I have students I send abroad, and a lot of times they go to Italy, and they see paintings of Francis. Now, their grandparents would see the same paintings depicting this event, and they would interpret these paintings as an angel coming down and doing this to him. But my students interpret it as a UFO beaming St. Francis, because of the infrastructure and the media infrastructure within which we live. So I cannot now see those types of things without also seeing both Catholic dogma and UFO dogma. The same thing is happening, but the interpretation is different.
So, okay, the process of interpretation is central to both religious and alien experiences. In both cases, one or more people have an experience, then they try to understand it and often refer to a text, like a scripture or teaching of some kind, which Pasulka calls the book encounter. 500 years ago in Europe, the book would have been the Bible. In indigenous societies, you might have an oral tradition and interpretations based on shared stories. And today they might come from any number of sources, books, films, or other media that help someone to understand what they experienced. And that's what's different from any other time in history, is that today we are saturated in media images far more than we have any conscious knowledge of. There's a story that's famous within the UFO and alien subculture, the case of Betty and Barney Hill. They were a married couple who, in September of 1961, were driving home late one night in southern New Hampshire when they claimed to have seen a bright light. They stopped the car, and what happened next is the subject of some controversy, but later they said they saw a spaceship and were abducted by the aliens on board. Shortly after the incident, Betty Hill had a book encounter. She checked a book on UFOs out of the library, and it corroborated her sense of what happened and helped her to interpret it as an alien encounter. A few years later, in a hypnotherapy session, her husband Barney Hill described and actually drew a sketch of the aliens they'd allegedly met. And here's what's interesting. According to Pasulka's book, what he drew was virtually identical to the aliens in an episode of a TV show called The Outer Limits, which had aired less than 2 weeks before he made the sketch. So how do we understand this? Was the entire encounter made up, perhaps a product of the unconscious mind? Or was it real in some way, but interpreted through the images at hand?
So I get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but it appears to be the case now that they had a real experience. Okay, I'm not denying that their experience didn't happen. What I'm saying, though, is that it was mediated completely through the outer limits, which is something that he had seen. And the being that he describes is exactly the beings that were in that show. My point is that the media bypasses a lot of what we consider to be our rational faculties, you know, our executive function, and goes straight to a different part of our brains and then settles there and actually creates more of what we remember than what our rational brains actually remember. And this is all solidified by research into memory and cognitive science and media.
But hasn't something like this always been the case? I mean, like when people saw miraculous apparitions of the Virgin Mary, they were already steeped in Mary iconography. Or if someone sees Jesus or Krishna or little gray aliens, aren't they simply taking the symbols and stories from their own lives and mapping it onto their experiences?
I see it that way, but a little bit differently. And this is the difference. Francis was hurt by whatever he interacted with. And today, people have visceral, tangible, like there are relics, physical objects. People see these things. They see them physically. Some of them get hurt by them. Some of them have an amazing religious experience from them. The first thing I wanted people to understand was that there is a new form of belief in like advanced non-human intelligence that takes the form of belief in what we call UFOs. I like to call it the phenomena because there are different forms of it and different ways to believe in it. However, this is a new form of religion. You know, it's not the traditional monotheistic religion. You know, in the past, people had visions, like indigenous cultures had visions, and their visions helped them understand themselves within the cosmos. Well, our visions now are given to us through media screens, either through our phones or through theater or watching it on our own TV or our own computer. And so, I mean, it's a game changer for everything, basically. But what my special field is religious studies. So it's a game changer for religion as well.
So what we're left with, as I understand it, and it's getting pretty challenging to wrap my mind around all this, but what seems clear is the following. Very strange things happen to people. Not everybody, obviously, but enough that it can be recognized as a phenomenon that occurs in all societies throughout history. In one era, it's all about fairies and gnomes. In another, it's about angels and demons. And today, aliens, among other things. To the people who are having them, religious or call it what you will, but these kinds of experiences are as fully real as everyday material existence, which is challenging to those of us who are raised to believe the only reality is what can be sensed with our five senses and measured. But let's take a step back. What are the other explanations for all these phenomena? Paul Davies, in his book The Eerie Silence, talks about the possibility of time travel and wormholes, which could make space travel over long distances quick and easy, though it's probably not something that we're going to do in the near future. But maybe intelligent aliens from another galaxy figured it out a long time ago. Is it possible that there are time travelers visiting from another time or dimension or parallel universe? One quickly gets into a place where science meets science fiction. So, is it even possible to get to the truth of the matter? Perhaps there are multiple truths. Paul Davies might be right in thinking that it's unlikely that there's intelligent alien life roaming the universe in spaceships. And Diana Pasulka might be right to interpret alien encounters as religious experience. But what about all the weird spacecrafts flying around, the Tic Tacs and the triangles, witnessed by innumerable people caught on radar, photographed? Are they religious phenomena? And what about Luis Elizondo's contention that we are not alone? And former Arizona Governor Fife Symington, who said pretty much the same thing. I had a long conversation with James Fox about all of this. He's a filmmaker whose documentaries include Out of the Blue and I Know What I Saw, and he's got a new film coming out, I think later this year, called The Phenomenon. He's devoted much of his adult life to reporting on UFOs, and here's what he says.
I know, beyond a shadow of doubt, there are structured craft of unknown origin whizzing around with impunity in our airspace. They're under intelligent control. They fly rings around our fastest jets. Their technology is light years ahead of us. And it's been that way since the 40s. And in fact, there have been reports dating back millennia. I'm not saying what these things are. I'm not saying they're aliens. I'm not saying they're coming from other planets. I don't know. I just don't know. And I don't think anybody does. I really don't. Maybe they do, but no one that I've met knows. I just don't know.
It's worth considering that maybe we're incapable of knowing. Maybe some of this is about learning to live with the fact that we can't know everything, that there are mysteries that we can't solve, although science doesn't like that perspective, and I understand that too. Or maybe it's that we haven't discovered the science that will allow us to understand, in the same way that we couldn't understand disease before we discovered germs. Or maybe we're not as intelligent as we think we are. Maybe there are alien intelligences all around us who look at us the way that we look at border collies. Yeah, they're intelligent within limits, but they can only do dog things. Maybe highly intelligent aliens are saying, oh, those cute little human animals, they're kind of smart within limits. But those are our limits. We can only do human things, like keep observing, keep our minds open, keep seeking the truth, and maybe it's out there. And before we go, I want to thank a bunch of people who helped with this program. Zaylee Pollan helped with the editing, Gail Tapscott and Matt Miller with the research, filmmakers Laurel Chaitin and James Fox gave us permission to use the footage from their documentaries, and by the way, keep an eye out for James Fox's film The Phenomenon coming soon. And also thanks to the Santa Fe Institute, which connected me with some wonderful scientists who helped me to think about the whole concept of aliens, and thanks to Ross Hamlin for his music. You've been listening to Thought Huddle. We're coming to you from Arizona State University. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. You can find us on iTunes, on your podcast app, and at thoughthuddle.com. Thanks to Nikai Salcido and Zaylee Pollan for production assistance on this podcast, and to Ross Hamlin for the music. And thanks to you for listening. On our next program, we'll be talking about mapping. So stay tuned, and we'll see you next time.